Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nicholas Investment Insights. This week we take another look at the drivers of the Australian dollar after a tumultuous year on the foreign exchange bourse. A little over a year ago, we saw the Australian dollar plunge to levels not seen for nearly 20 years as the global pandemic collapsed confidence in many major currencies. Since then, there's been a marked resurgence in our dollar as global central bank quantitative easing, or blatant money creation, has contributed to relative weakness of other currencies, with the US dollar no exception. Locally, there's been discussion that our own Reserve Bank of Australia's monetary easing policies have contributed to our dollar being as much as 5% lower than it would normally be. However, with spiking virus cases, particularly in Europe, global central bank peers are showing no sign of reducing their own policies, and we now may find ourselves in a potential currency race to the bottom. So now the question remains, in the face of rising commodity prices and terms of trade, and the recent broader, stronger US dollar trend, have we seen a peak in the Pacific peso leading to a lower Aussie dollar from here? And what are the primary drivers that we should be considering in forecasting it? Joining us today to share his thoughts on the future of the AUD and its relevant impacts on our portfolios, we have Nicholas Wells, Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And sitting across from Damien and next to myself, we've of course got our own Chief Strategist and Currency Specialist, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hello to you, David.
G'day, Tim.
Good to have you on. And just a quick reminder that before we get started, if you haven't already, subscribe, of course, and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, and follow us on your preferred podcast platform. We also ask if you'd like to take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. And for those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat to have them answered along the way. We'll jump into our agenda for today. We're going to kick off today with looking, as we do, at our five drivers model. We're going to kick off with global and Australian growth, move on to interest rate differentials, across to investor sentiment and technicals, the relative strength of the US dollar, as I mentioned before, and then, of course, rounding that out, as we always do, the investment impacts on how we run our portfolios here at Nicholas Wealth and the MB Fund. So with no further ado, we'll kick off with global and Australian growth, gentlemen.
Yeah, well, obviously we're having a much better year this year than last. And the outlook is for, you know, strengthening of that very quickly and very strongly as we go through this extraordinary vaccine wave that's sweeping the developed world and a little more slowly in the emerging markets, with the exception of Australia, although long ago we probably put that in the emerging markets bucket. And so, you know, typically the Australian dollar would do very well in this environment. Anytime you have a big global rebound, you typically would get rising commodity prices, and the Aussie dollar is kind of largely considered a proxy for global growth. For some of those reasons, and so this is a classic environment for a strong Australian dollar, which is, you know, really explains its meteoric rise since the crash in March last year. However, if we go through these prospective growth outlooks, oh, there's a nice tautology for you. If we go through the prospective growth for the major global regions, sorry, back one. I'm going to argue that this is actually a very atypical cycle.
Okay.
So starting from the top, we've got the US economy, which is, you know, doing an exceptional job with its vaccine rollout, and as a result is seeing, you know, a catch-up growth surge, along with, you know, some pretty phenomenal fiscal spending, as well as very loose monetary policy, which is generated, you know, big asset market returns, and so has lifted a lot of household wealth. And there's a lot of excess saving and what have you that no doubt will get run down in the next few years. And so basically, you know, where the US is entering the kind of boom we haven't seen there probably since the millennium, maybe even since the 1950s, for the next year or 18 months at least. Because the phenomenon of catch-up growth is very, very powerful.
And the other thing is the the type of stimulus they have planned at the moment seems to be very much targeted towards demand. Like, it's the type of stimulus you'd, if you sat down with an economist and said, what type of stimulus would you like? Would you like us to just do some tax cuts for companies and let everything trickle down? Or would you like us to actually try and get infrastructure going and you know, get childcare rebate to get more people out working and, mm-hmm. you know, all these factors like that. That is exactly the type of scenario you'd get where the economists would come back and go, yes, we want this type of growth because it's going to spread the wealth more and it's going to generate demand, which is then going to feed upon itself. Whereas when you've got heaps of supply, you're doing what Australia is trying to do, which is let's try and encourage companies to get out there and build more capacity.
It's more supply.
Is not a, is not as positive.
Yeah. Okay. That said, the US has another stimulus package coming, which is supply focused. That's the infrastructure package, which will more or less kick off into 2022, and that's more supply-based with infrastructure and a lot of human development as well, so education and health and what have you. But again, that's more supply-based, or it's probably more accurate to say productivity-based.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that's where I'm guessing coming from the demand side. Anyway, I guess I look upon infrastructure that's needed as saying, well, first of all, you're going to get out and create jobs for people who wouldn't have otherwise been working. And then secondly, you'll actually improve productivity for other members of society.
You will. I've looked at the package and it looks fantastic, which is a real shock coming from Australia to see really well-considered policy.
Coming from anywhere for the last few years.
Well, true enough. We've been through some pretty rotten policy for quite a while, but the new fiscal package coming out of the Biden administration looks really good. And at $2 trillion, it'll probably trickle out at $300 to $400 million a year for, you know, maybe 8 years, which you can do the math on the political cycle and see that basically matches, you know, two terms in the White House. And it's going to lift growth there by 1.5% per annum, which is pretty huge for a long period of time.
Yep.
So the US is basically leading out of the pandemic, as it were, in both in terms of quality of policy and quantity. So it's got this huge surge of growth underway, and it's obviously going to come off. Like, I mean, this year it could grow anywhere up to sort of 8%. It's going to come back to 3 and 4, but, you know, a US growing at 3+ over an extended period is very different to what we've saw in the last cycle, where we saw it struggling to get to 2 for years. And that will be a very important point that I'll come back to. So to this point, China's actually largely led the world because it went into the pandemic first and came out first. But it's already tightening, you know, materially in terms of monetary policy particularly, but also a little bit of fiscal. So we see China's going to grow very well in the first half of this year, but some of that tightening is going to start to come to bear in the second half of this year, and then very much so in 2023. I think it'll slow really sharply. So, you know, that has implications for commodity prices, etc. And we'll come back to why that growth mix with the US leading and China slowing is really important for the Australian dollar.
I think I know where you're leading with this.
So then we got Europe, which has got a little bit of fiscal. You know, it did manage to break the mold to the extent that it's going to have some infrastructure spending. But it's miles behind on the vaccine. And it's just potential growth is much lower. It's got, you know, all sorts of intrinsic problems that are still not resolved, including lots of debt.
Yeah, and it sort of set those artificial targets for how big the deficits can be for countries.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like saying, well, maybe we can go a little bit more than that, as opposed to saying, okay, we've just got to blow it away for a year or two, and then we can go. You might want to come back to it later, but yeah, it's very much
So more of the same from Europe. It'll get a catch-up growth spurt maybe in the second half of this year and then tipping over into 2023. So it's going to have some good times as well, but much lower than the US and tapering off much more quickly.
And it's worth saying as well that they're very export focused in terms of that area. So you've got to wait for the US boom to happen first, so that'll then feed through into the
UK. A slowing China affects Europe a lot. It's got a lot of exports to China. So that means it's catch up boom will have a relatively short half life. Japan is just more of the same. That is Japanification. We can pretty much gloss over that. Australia, you know, we're going great at the moment. We had a really good pandemic, obviously, because we used our island to good effect.
That's right.
But our vaccine rollout is nothing short of a disaster in developed economy terms and in fact, third world terms as well.
Which is fascinating because it's like the ability to open up the country and get this, you know, unlimited growth, you know, motor happening again is so vaccine dependent that...
Yeah. It's, you know, look, I got all sorts of problems on the vaccine front and reopening Australia to the world. My sense is this is reflected in some surveys, but just the news flow on the vaccine rollout is really bad. We're completely dependent on AstraZeneca, which is obviously the one that's had the worst press. Not all of it warranted. You know, the health issues that have come up for it are very manageable and quite rare, but they're nonetheless there. And there's just a lot of negativity around the whole rollout, which means I think hesitancy on vaccines here is going to be quite high.
And the difference with other countries, obviously, is a place like Canada where, yes, problems with one vaccine. Okay, you just go to the other vaccines, but you've got...
Yes.
Whereas we've just put all our eggs in one basket.
Which was extraordinarily foolish of the Morrison government, but anyway, it's done. But the problem, the important point is that the problem may linger because, for instance, we do expect other vaccines to come in the second half in volume. We're supposed to get more Pfizer and then there's Novavax. But we don't even have a deal with Johnson & Johnson, for instance, which is going to be turned into the absolute COVID killer. That's the one shot, room temperature stored, easy delivery one that you can just literally get down at the supermarket. And we don't have a deal with them even. So we're going to basically stay behind. Like, we may catch up and overtake some of the developing countries. I certainly hope so. But it's a lingering problem. Then our fiscal mix is pretty poor as well. As Damo said, a lot of it has been oriented towards corporate giveaways, incentivizing investment in areas that we don't need. So it's more supply on top of excess supply. So to summarize that then, maybe we'll just quickly reference the chart.
I was going to say.
So where this kind of comes to bear most critically in two ways. First is the terms of trade, that is the relative relationship between our export prices and our import prices, which are driven by commodities, basically. And as you can see on the chart, we've almost returned to the highs of the, you know, super cycle booms of the past. However, because we see China tightening, the US leadership and fiscal pulse is not very commodity intensive. We think that the key commodity prices will all fall pretty dramatically over the next 12 months. And so that driver of the Aussie dollar is going to fall pretty sharply.
And so I put out a piece just the other day on just looking at the copper market, which is probably one of the better ones for, you know, longer term outlook of the switched EVs. And so, you know, the CRU group came out and basically is saying they think that if they get $1 trillion of US stimulus, that equals about another $110 million of 110,000 tons of copper, which sounds, you know, as big, but it's like 0.3 of the world demand. So it's like it's basically this tiny little increase in terms of the amount of copper needed. And so whereas the Chinese building market is actually where the action is. It doesn't really matter what US is doing on its infrastructure.
Yep.
And as Dave was talking about before, when we're talking about $2 trillion, it's actually once, you know, the roads and everything is only going to be $600 or $700 billion.
Yep.
And it's starting to get more into, you know, childcare subsidies and things like that.
Services people
US,
money.
Yeah. So the terms of trade are going to fall despite strong global growth, and that's going to be exacerbated by this last point here, which is what I've got. This is really the critical calculus, I think, for this dimension of the Aussie dollar, which is in the last two cycles, America has basically led the bust.
Okay.
So we had the dot-com bust,
mm-hmm.
and we had the GFC bust. And it, coming out of both of those, the US had very, very low inflation, even deflation scares, real growth problems.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was having a lot of trouble generating growth, you know, to lower unemployment, et cetera, et cetera. And so monetary policy was really easy for a long time. In part, it was so difficult because they didn't do fiscal. Like they were busy tightening fiscal, because that was the, you know, the
government of the day.
The way of, well, it was the ideology of the day.
Yep.
And while the US was doing so much to try and stimulate itself, it was therefore, you know, very much debasing its dollar relative to other countries. And a lot of this stimulus simply flowed off to China and mobilized Chinese labor. Right. So there was all the huge outsourcing pushes into China. And so, you know, it was almost like a self-defeating cycle for the US. This time around, it's the reverse, where you have lots of US fiscal. You still got very, very loose monetary policy, but because you've got so much fiscal, there's the, you know, basically there's the scope for earlier tightening in monetary policy. There'll be more inflation than there was, and heaps more growth.
Yep.
And a big focus as well on onshoring. Not that they'll be that successful, you know, when these things, when things boom and US dollar goes up, you know, offshoring sort of a bit natural, but at least they're fighting back against it rather than just sort of lying back and
thinking. Absolutely. So it's deglobalizing rather than globalizing as a trend rather than something acute. So yes, absolutely. So, and at the same time, when you used to have this weak US, you know, basically driving strong Chinese development, China is taking advantage of this new US growth driver to deal with its own internal problems developed over the last 10 or 15 years with overinvestment and debt. So in other words, China's going to slow while America stays really strong.
And sorry, just to put that in sort of very thumbnail, bigger picture terms for anyone who hasn't sort of been listening to that. China's spending close to 50% of its GDP gets spent on infrastructure, sorry, on investment and capital expenditure. And that's just like, you know, double or triple what you see in most other countries. And it's just so far above. And their problem is that they're so dependent upon that infrastructure, and they've already built out so much, is that every time they run into problems, that part starts to slow down. They just have to throw more money at it. And they know they're unbalanced and they want to get back to consumption spending, but it's so difficult to do once you've tied yourself to it.
Yep.
And so what David's saying is, you know, as consumption booms, because of US or exports might, you know, pick up because of the US strength, in, they'll use that to then start trying to wind back their investment side and actually rely more on consumption and exports to drive the economy.
And we've seen it over and again. When the Chinese economy slows, they tend to stimulate some more. And like, we're not saying this will be a one-way ticket to slower Chinese growth. They're always ebbing and flowing between the need to keep growth high enough to be politically sound.
Acceptable.
But it's time for an ebb now. We've had the flow over the last 6-12 months.
Yes, but we're in the tightening phase now, where they'll slow. And each time it's been a kind of flight path lower in GDP. So this is the critical point in terms of Australian and global growth. It's going to be led by the US and slowed by China, which is the complete flip side of the last two cycles. Which gives you a stronger US dollar, basically, than you've gotten in the previous cycles. But we'll come back to that. So the immediate implication of this, if we flip over to the next page, so that means that the terms of trade are likely to come off relatively quickly. The other big driver of the Aussie dollar is interest rate differentials, which obviously is an expression to an extent of global growth and relative inflation.
And so actually I'll just give you one step back as well for anyone who's wondering what this is. So basically this is 10-year bond yields. We'll use that as the example. So how much the US government can borrow at, or how much the yields you can get on US bonds versus Aussie bonds. And so you can see on the chart, or anyone who can't see the chart, is, you know, you reached about 5% where the Australian bond, 10-year bond yields were, or maybe actually 2-year bond yields, sorry, were sort of almost 5% above what you got, what you see in the US. So a significant
2%, wasn't it? Not five.
Oh, sorry. I'm talking about the 2-year bonds. And then 2% on the 10-year bonds.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then as you, it's just been that steady line down where last year the Aussie bonds were yielding less than the US bonds for the first time in whatever it was, 20-odd years. And we're back roughly at zero now. So pretty close to difference between Aussie and US yields.
And just to expand on that, so those big differentials are often what brings on the carry trades and turbocharged over parity dollars like we saw post-GFC.
Yeah,
so
back
not there
in,
now.
So back in the sort of early 2000s, you'd say, you know, there are people out there who would go, I will borrow in US dollars and pay a 2% yield and I'll just go and buy Aussie government bonds and get a 5% or 6%.
Thanks for playing. Yep.
Exactly.
Yep.
And so, yeah, and just as you said, that carry that trade to so you just get more demand for the Australian and
And that's notably absent now. So that's
And you can see like how big the carry was around, say, post GFC, when, as we were discussing, US growth was really struggling, China was booming, mm-hmm. Australia was riding the back of China. And so that's when the Aussie went to 111. Mm-hmm. You know, this chart was key then. And it's completely different now. We've had a rebound to about parity in terms of yield. Sorry, not in terms of currency. But I'd actually argue that we're going to flip negative before long on this chart again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the US growth pulse is going to be much stronger over the next, say, political cycle, 3 to 4 years, than the Australian one will be. And, you know, the Fed's going to be forced to tighten long before the RBA does, in my view. So,
and we've seen that just in recent times. You know, the Australian RBA came out with what's called yield curve control, so they're actually actively out there buying longer-term bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was expecting that the Fed would shortly come out and do the same thing, and the Fed basically just stay quiet. They were.
Wow.
So they're sort of, for the first time in a long, long time, the Australian Central Bank is doing more than what they're
doing.
the
more manipulation than the US.
Yes, well, quite right. And 10 years too late. But it is doing it, and it's already got on deck alternative policies for if things like housing get overheated.
Mm.
It's going to go macroprudential. All of that is quite clear. Stuff it should have done years ago, it's actually going to do this time. And, you know, the US inflation and growth pulse is going to be strong enough at least for the Fed to be tapering this time next year. So taking off its quantitative easing and asset purchases.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, markets are already pricing 2 rate hikes for next year in the US. I think that's probably overly aggressive. But as we saw in 2013, once the Fed starts to pull the asset purchases, that's quite tightening for the currency as well.
Absolutely.
So, you know, Australia will still be printing money and the US won't. And so, you know, that interest rate differential, I think, will flip again negative and probably stay that way for quite a while.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
And so those are your key two major drivers of the Aussie dollar right there, both of which are behaving quite atypically for this time in the business cycle, early in the business cycle. So if we're going to want to go over to our third driver, which is more kind of market technicals and micro market stuff. At the moment, just flip over one more there. One more slide.
This is it.
Yes. So this is just relative market positioning at the moment, which is sort of minorly Australian dollar bullish. You can see that if you're looking at this chart, you can see that it was very negative for a number of years as we went through that negative yield spread over the last couple of years in Australia as we really struggled through that low inflation environment, especially with our high immigration rate really killing wages growth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's an open question as to whether we go back to that economic model. If we didn't, then that would certainly lift some of the pressure on wages and may generate some tightening from the RBA a little more quickly than we're talking about. But
for anyone uninterested, we spoke to Ross Gunner a few weeks ago about exactly that and spent a long time talking about, you know, why the old economic model isn't going to work now. Yeah. And he's sort of got his prescription. But it doesn't look as if the Morrison government has completely thrown away the old model, and it's quite possible that's what they'll wheel out.
Look, they're absolutely dedicated to the old model. In fact, they just did a review in the Senate to looking at temporary work visas, and their plan is to pretty much give them open borders to businesses. They can bring in workers at will. That said, my contention is they're going to lose the next election, about 12 months away. I think that that's... Well, these things are never certain, but I think that's the base case.
Yep.
And Labor has been more hawkish on those kinds of visas, but they are still very committed to population growth. So there'd be a better balance under Labor, but I don't think it would be... It certainly wouldn't be closed borders or Fortress Australia.
And we've still got the whole vaccine piece to play out over the next 12 months.
And the vaccine problem, which is going to pose a big problem getting the borders open for the Morris administration over the next 12 months before we get there.
Yep.
And so that political cycle is a factor in terms of these things. But at the moment, the market is basically neutral on the Aussie dollar. It's been through a really weak spot and it's come back to neutral. So at this point, that doesn't really bear terribly on price action and where it's going to go.
And you know, my point is that the last 6 months or so, it's been a little bit positive, a little bit negative, a little bit positive, a little bit negative. There's obviously we've reached a confusion. No, you know, there's differing views out there in the market as to which way it's going.
Sort of that feels like that mid 70s range sort of seems. Would you say that's sort of been historically where you sort of see it? Well, at least over the last few years,
most models sort of have that at fair value. And so you need an unusual circumstance either way to drive it above or below.
And keep in mind, though, at the moment, the unusual circumstance is we've got record terms of trade. So we're at middle of the range and record terms of trade. Ordinarily, record terms of trade would mean...
Off she goes.
Record highs.
So
that's... I guess what we've been saying is, you know, the only thing holding it up is just been commodity prices. And so if your contention is commodity prices are going to stay high for... If you don't agree with us and you think, yes, this is this great super cycle and commodity prices are going to be high for the next, you know, 10 years, then the Aussie dollar will be going up.
That's right.
But our contention, as we've sort of been following through over the last few weeks, is no, it doesn't look like a super cycle. It's a super cycle in prices. It's not a super cycle in volumes.
Yep.
So, and if you've got a super cycle in prices but not volumes, that just means more supply comes on.
Yep. And it's a weaker prop.
It's a cycle. It's not a super cycle.
Very good.
Yeah. It's a recovery cycle. So if we want to flip over to the next one. So technicals is our fifth factor. And this one, you know, has the appearance of being bearish insofar as, you know, we've had this big run up and reached levels more or less equivalent to the last time we had a big pop in commodity prices around 2015. And we've sort of generated, we've come off that a little and we've created what is known as a head and shoulders topping pattern. And this is the sort of stuff that traders look at to make, you know, place their bets. There's a thing at the bottom of these two shoulders, left and right, that I've marked here on the chart on the far right-hand side. You have what is called the neckline of this pattern, and if that breaks decisively, then you get considerable downside. I mean, this is technical analysis, which is really, you know, voodoo stuff, but it's not to be discounted entirely in the short term. In fact, I know traders that make a small fortune doing nothing but this stuff. And so it works because certain people use it think it works. You know,
I think a bit of herd mentality starts to kick in.
There's a little bit of that. And there's also a little bit, though, in terms of it being, you know, the way these things tend to happen is that there's no certainty in these and people sort of going, okay, well, they think things are getting better for the Australian economy and so the dollar goes up a little bit and then things do get a little bit better and so the dollar kept going up and there's you don't have that certainty that commodity prices are going to... So it doesn't sort of jump straight from 60 cents up to 80 cents.
No.
It sort of just gradually works its way up as you get more certainty.
Yep.
And then it starts hitting this point where you're going, okay, now is it going to go one way or the other? And so, you know, and I guess the flip side technical view would be, hey, we're in this nice big broad channel going upwards and going to keep going upwards for some time.
You could look at it that way, absolutely. And I'll add that the Aussie's been floating around the neckline, as I called it, or it is called, for the last few weeks. It's broken through a few times. It's been waffling around there, but and technical levels and stuff are really not relevant unless they break.
Yep.
So you can look at this until you're blue in the face, and if it doesn't actually, you know, kind of develop into a break of a key level, then it's useless.
Sure.
But any Forex trader looking at this chart will be thinking, shit, if that breaks, I'm going short.
That's it, you're out. Yeah,
exactly. Way. And so so it's more along there's that, as David's talking about, that little bit of an air gap where people are like, okay, I'll hold my holding, but you know what, if it goes, breaks, you know, whatever, 74, I guess, that'd be the level?
No, it's high 75s, the neckline.
So. Right. So yeah, so if it goes below that, you might quickly see a few cents knocked off.
Knocked off, yeah, okay. Yeah. So momentum sort of kicks in and off she goes.
Yeah, that's right. So you would say, you'd look at that and say, well, clearly there's downside risk if that level breaks. But the up channel is there and, you know, so...
Yeah, let's go on to the next.
Relative strength. Yep. Actually, and just before we do, I'll just shout out to all those listening in to pop in questions in the live chat as well, just as we're moving through. We're happy to answer those. So, yeah.
And this is the fifth factor, which is the opposite side of the cross, which obviously has relevance to any
absolutely
currency price. So, and this goes to... I guess two factors. What we've already discussed with US leadership and exceptionalism at the beginning of the cycle, which is very atypical and unusual. And so that's going to obviously give the US dollar a lift. And the right-hand chart here, this is from T.S. Lombard, this chart is an example of that, where you've actually had, the
smirk.
The US smirk, where you would typically get these cycles through the end of one business cycle and the beginning of another or into the middle of another. But this one's much more accelerated.
And actually, I should just explain that chart. Basically, they're saying if growth is really bad, then the US dollar rises because there's a flight to safety.
Mm-hmm.
And then if growth is really good, then the US dollar goes up because the US economy is stronger than the rest of the world and everything.
Yep.
And in the middle, it's falling.
Okay.
So it's sort of in that mediocre growth bit is where and this is US growth relative to the rest of the world growth. And so, the question is, where do you think US growth is going? And our view is it's going to be stronger than the rest of the world.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Now, the sort of flip side of this is the twin deficits theory, which is not really a theory. It's more or less practice, which is when you have any economy delivering both a fiscal and current account trade deficit
mm-hmm.
or current account deficit, I should say, then it tends to have a weak currency because, you know, that's not a promising sign for the sustainability of your growth cycle.
Yep.
Because you're obviously over-consuming and the government's spending a lot of money anyway, and so you've got a few problems.
Mm.
And there's sort of devaluation factors at work in that scenario. So normally... the currency would follow the twin deficits. Now, this is almost getting into risk factors for our base case here, but which we'll come back to. But Lombard's arguing that the twin deficits are actually going to start to look better in the near future.
Okay.
Because even though we've got more fiscal stimulus coming, there's a huge wave of it that's about to pass, and so the budget deficit is going to improve.
Okay,
And I'd also make the argument that the budget deficit would also depend upon. To me, it's the net government deficit after central banks have bought. You know, because if you're in a budget deficit of whatever 500 billion, but the central banks actually bought 400 billion of that, then your deficit is only 100 really that you need external financing for.
Okay. Yeah.
And so...
No, it's a very good point.
I think there's... if you're looking at the headline numbers, it can look a lot bigger than what it actually is in actual
terms. That said, if the central bank's printing that money, then it's probably not going to please anyone in terms of the value of that currency. But but it's still a factor. So... in terms of the trade and current account deficits, they're certainly not about to diminish. The current account deficit's not likely to diminish quickly in the US. But as global growth lifts, know, as the whole world comes out of the vaccine, then its trade deficit will probably improve as well. Especially as the oil prices improves a bit more and stuff, and shale gets going and whatever. So the twin deficit stuff is likely to improve a little, but that is a headwind, a structural headwind for the US dollar. And I guess what I'm arguing really is that the cycle is so atypical that it will overwhelm it.
Right. Yep. Okay.
But that does bring us to a risk factor for this outlook, which is if global growth really does recover a lot, and say, you know, Europe gets its act together,
yep,
and the vaccine rollout accelerates, and it turns out that it booms, you know, out of the pandemic, then one of the risk factors is there might be a period where the US dollar falls again.
Okay. You know, yep.
Because typically when you get really strong global growth, if it's not too strong and if it's led by Europe, then the euro will start to firm up.
Well, it's your middle of the your smirk.
Yeah, the middle of the smirk again.
Yeah.
But that's
jump to the next slide, actually.
That's a risk case or a time case where you might just get a small period where Europe's strong enough to weigh against the US dollar. So you might get a period of that consolidation or even falls again for the US dollar. But the tailwind on US growth is too big and too sustainable, we think, for that weakness to be sustained.
And just quickly on that as well. So the it sort of feels like we're moving into a little bit of uncharted territory, having such a broad, and I'm sure it's been done in the past, but this demand side Bidenomics stimulus sort of package that he's put together. And obviously there's a conversation around inflation and short-term inflation, obviously, and that's, you know, obviously the bulk of what we've been talking about today. You know, could that be a concern for markets, though, that it's too effective? Like
you mean an inflationary bust?
Yeah, essentially.
Yes. Look, there are lots of inflationista out there at the moment saying just that.
Yeah.
That basically a lot of fiscal spending will generate you know, wage rises, and you'll get a wage push cycle into inflation.
Yep.
We actually hope that happens because we think the US desperately needs it, and it'll be a great way to kill off Donald Trump. We don't think that that's the base case, simply because the structural headwinds to inflation are still really big. And one of the keys is what we've described already in China, which is we think China's going to start weighing on commodity prices pretty heavily, pretty quickly. And even though you might be getting some endogenous inflation in the US through wages, it's going to be having some exogenous deflation coming in pretty strongly.
Yep.
So, you know, this is actually another argument for the US dollar, insofar as we see stronger endogenous inflation in the US and weak global inflation coming out, largely because of China, but also because, you know, Europe's so hopeless.
You know? Yeah, that's a fair point.
And the lagging vaccine recoveries in the emerging markets, etc.
Yep.
And so that argument wouldn't upset the Forex argument, for instance, for a stronger US dollar and a weaker Australian dollar.
Yep, fair enough. All right.
I wanted to run through some of the other risks as well. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to, just the first one and the most important one is just a reminder that, you know, we are in basically a central bank and government stimulus driven economy and stock market. And, you know, the real key to this whole thing is when all that matters is you know, how much central banks are spending and how much governments are spending, is that policy error is your number one issue. Is keeping an eye on, you know, we've said it's, you know, all these markets held up by liquidity, held up by government policies, you know, preventing people from going broke, government policies letting people have mortgages where they don't have to pay it, government policies letting people not get evicted for not paying their rent, you know, all the huge waves of fiscal stimulus right around the world. Policy error is your number one issue you need to keep an eye on, because if suddenly you know, the thought goes out that, hey, we've won this, everything's fine, we can pull back everything, central banks can start raising interest rates, you know,
all the protections come away.
Yep. Then you know, all the, exactly. Then yep. we're in trouble. And given the amount of debt that's out there, is that we do need to be quite cognizant of what can cause problems that
topple
can't
over.
Solve.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Yep.
And so that's sort of the number one. Yeah, I'll actually jump to the number three one as well, and that is the emerging markets issue. So if I run through all the areas where things can go wrong, you know, corporate debt's really high. You could see some more bankruptcies. We think what's central banks sort of broken the seal on that one and said, look, we're going to prop up we're going to make sure the corporate debt market doesn't get too expensive. They're going to limit how big the fallout is.
Yep, sure.
As much as possible. So to probably get that under control, if we have any sort of debt crises, if you start getting more unemployment and weaker, you know, there can be more fiscal thrown at it. And we think that's probably the base case is, mm-hmm. you know, too much weakness. The one place where you can sort of say, where could there be a lot of debt that central banks won't ride to the rescue is emerging markets, where if you start seeing the US dollar rising quite strongly and then you start seeing debts get too high. So mm-hmm. basically what we saw in the Asian crisis
okay.
was that US dollar ran up. That then started causing problems for all these countries that have borrowed in US dollars, and then you ended up with an emerging markets crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's probably the most likely. It's not. I'm not saying it's a base case or anything, but that's the area which we're sort of keeping an eye on to make sure, because that's one area where I think there's widespread acceptance now if governments step in and bail out individuals and help them with their paying their mortgages, and there's widespread acceptance that's what central banks are sorting out companies and not letting too much bankruptcies go on there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you've got acceptance for even within the euro. Even within something like a currency block like the euro, where if Greece starts to have bigger problems again, we saw how much fighting there was last time about how much money got transferred.
Mm.
And so if it's somewhere like countries like Turkey or South America, with debt crises, you're unlikely to see the US saying, yes, we'd like to throw more money at fixing problems in these other countries.
Yeah, it's a great point. Actually, just while we're on the euro, there's a question there. Thanks, Eric, for what is the considered outlook the euro relative to the AUD? We've spoken a lot about the USD cross, but
look, I'd probably say roughly neutral.
Mm, okay.
Because one of the key inputs into this is that Europe won't be as strong as the US over the next say 3 or 4 years.
Yep.
and China will be dragging Europe down as well. Those two factors tend to affect both currencies, Europe and the Australian dollar. And in fact, if you look at that cross over the long term, it tends towards neutral.
Mm-hmm.
Like they tend to move together.
Yep.
There are periods where they get very exaggerated moves, like for instance after the GFC, when you had the European crisis and the Aussie going nuts.
Yep. Okay.
But I don't expect anything like that this
bonds,
time.
Bonds about the same. Going to have low. Low
yes.
bond yields over there,
yes.
low bond yields
yes.
over here.
Yes, yes,
yep. No carry trade blowing it up?
No. Europe has developed into quite a funding currency these days, but there's no uplift into Australia unless you're getting a mortgage.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
But I'd expect roughly neutral, basically. Yeah, I can't be more specific than that. I'd
okay.
expect them both to fall over time.
Yep, sure.
Versus the US dollar, and therefore be roughly even.
Great answer. Thank you. We've got a couple of others there, but maybe we'll just finish off with the risks, or we're pretty happy with the risks completed through.
Do you want to do the European growth rebound?
I've kind of done that one.
Yeah.
Already.
Yeah. Yeah, let's go through some of the questions. Oh, sorry, I guess virus vaccines.
Yep.
That's your other big risk is variants that get around the vaccines.
Okay.
Or problems with vaccines rollouts in Europe and Australia and... Yeah, place like that. So that they, obviously they other risk factors you need to keep an eye on.
Mutations is probably another one as well.
Yeah, new
viruses.
Yeah, look, the stuff I've been reading of late is reasonably reassuring.
Yep.
On that front, they're not quite the same as flu viruses, coronaviruses. They mutate slower, and I've even read some stuff saying that it's not an infinite.
Mutation sort of
that
we'll find ourselves in. That's good to know.
Yeah, and I think the speed at which we developed so many different viable vaccine says chances are mutations will be solvable with relatively small changes to existing ones.
Yep.
Yeah.
Is one thing. And the other one I was going to say was...
And as we've mentioned, like with J&J, like the second and third generation vaccines will be much, much more logistically simple as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Okay. And the other thing on the vaccine side and shutdowns is that human beings are great adapters. You know, when there was a shutdown in March of last year and nobody had ever seen this thing for decades, it was obviously a huge shock to the system. As each shutdown happens, people know the drill, and they've now developed plans for if there is a shutdown, then this is what happens. And so it's not a matter of production falling, you know, 50-60%. It's more of a, you know, 10-20%
subdued
range
shock.
To the exactly. And so
now, well, Europe's third wave is a good example.
Yes, exactly.
Like their manufacturing PMIs are through the roof. They haven't shut a single factory, and services are down.
Yep,
like they're recessionary, but they're nothing like the wipeouts
of
the first waves.
I guess, a good practical example of that's that Asia's response in this pandemic, thanks to their previous sort of...
Yeah, that's right. You know,
They've been through SARS and MERS, and so they were much more effective at dealing with this one.
So here we go again, get the masks out of the bottom drawer of the kitchen and get on with it.
Exactly. It's not a wonder about where can we get masks from, do we need to switch... Yeah.
Why are we wearing these things again? It's just that it's taken as given. Okay. A few more questions there. Where would we like to begin? Will we see earnings growth provide a strong enough tailwind to justify 35 times
CAGR 10?
Yep.
Yeah. So what we're looking at here is this is the cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio, and so this is basically looking at a 10 years worth of earnings and making adjustments and for inflation and trying to average it out. I think that the key thing for me to think about from this is to flip this ratio around. So people talk about looking at this ratio and saying, okay, you know, ordinarily it might be 20 or below 20, and then now it's 35. So you're like, wow, that's so much higher than what it is. And the issue is, I think it sounds a lot worse when you look at it that way. If you invert it and think about it as a yield, when it's 20, it's a 5% yield.
Yep.
When it's 35, now it's a 3% yield. So if you're talking about, think about it as a yield, it doesn't look as bad, first of all. So as a yield, if it falls from 3 to 1, again, it's obviously a big fall, but that's a difference of going from 35 to 100.
Yeah.
So the scale gets out of whack, makes it seem like it's bigger changes than what it really is at the top level. But the real question really comes back to, will you see earnings growth that will actually come through?
Yep.
Look, we're seeing a lot of earnings growth from companies, and it's actually very good sort of bottom line. Sales haven't fully recovered and you're still getting a lot through. I think companies had a really good look. Most companies had a really good look at their cost structure mid last year and just cut anything that they didn't need. And now they're really reaping the benefits. Do I think you're going to get a lot of earnings growth? Yes. Do I think you'll justify a 35 times? I don't know. But you know, I guess you're talking about a 3% yield, which you could turn into a 4% yield with earnings growth, and then maybe a 5%. You're probably stretching it, but you know. And then you're looking at bond yields of 0.
I was going to say, absence of anything else that's yielding, you just happily take something.
And so I guess what I'd be saying is, look, you need to consider about saying, if we're in a normal economy without governments spending and without these massive amounts of stimulus and massive amounts of liquidity, then yes, you could justify. Then you wouldn't be able to justify current prices.
Sure.
The question comes about saying, it's almost as if, so we've got this. This Grand Canyon we need to get through. So at one side you're saying, okay, the prices are all right and they've got this Grand Canyon, and should prices fall down and then gradually recover as earnings recover? And you go, yeah, they probably should. But the issue is, if you're going to sit in cash because you're saying things are too expensive right now, and prices get held to where they are and maybe edging up over the next few years, then maybe in 3 or 4 years time you can justify those prices. So you get sort of, and you'll have never had a chance to buy in. So you might just get this slow grind higher of equities. You're getting a decent yield in terms of equities, much better yield than what you're getting in bonds.
Comparatively.
And so you're basically sitting there going, even if prices went nowhere and you're picking up a 3-4% yield, And you've missed out on that by sitting in cash for, for 3 or 4 years, and then earnings does actually justify the prices, and you've just never had a chance to buy in.
Okay.
So, so I think there's certainly a hope that, you know, if prices fell and you'd be able to get in at cheaper rates. But given the manipulation and the amount of liquidity in the markets, you know, we're not expecting that to happen. We're quite defensively positioned just in case it does.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's a matter of trying to get as much. Try not to fall too far behind. And so if you're going to sit in cash the whole time, we think you'll miss out.
Mm, okay, very good. Might jump across to moral hazard and debt. And this is a question sort of centrally, we've spoken about bulk commodities. We haven't spoken too much about oil, but how about those shale drillers from Simon? Thank you. Will a higher oil price save the day?
Save which day? My view on oil is supply discipline's already breaking.
Okay.
There are a lot of oil bulls mm-hmm. in the market. Wall Street's an absolute crazed oil bull, arguing for a new structural super cycle in oil, which I think is absolute poppycock.
Mm-hmm.
There's still 10, 12 million barrels per day offline in both shale and OPEC.
Yep.
And, you know... shale's coming back now already, and the rigs are coming out. They're much lower than they were the last cycle, but every time we go through one of these pulses, productivity soars, and so you need far fewer rigs to get the same output. And so I think
it comes on way quicker. The shale comes on way quicker than like, you know, other conventional wells. You know, take years and years
huge
and years to come on.
Time.
Yep. The shale ones are...
So 3 to 6 months, US oil production's going to be going through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for the last OPEC meeting, it was celebrated by a lot of analysts because it wasn't as bearish for the price as they thought it would be, but it was still bearish.
Yeah, right.
You know, like both OPEC and Saudi, with their unilateral cuts, have agreed to start dripping supply back in. There'll be another 2 million barrels over the next 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's a manipulated market, and the manipulators are starting to look nervous.
Yep.
So,
well, and that's the key, though, is that manipulated market is absolutely the part where you're going, well, at current prices, it's manipulated in either direction, you know, can be... Will you get a lot more supply come on and push it down? Will they keep supply off? And as demand comes back, you know, is that part of... You're down to a few decisions by a few people in, you know, mainly Saudi Arabia.
In towers, yep.
The issue is, though, prices are now high enough, and if they go any higher, they're certainly very much incentivizing the shale guys to come on quickly. And mm-hmm. at that point... You know, the Saudis and other people in the OPEC need to start saying, okay, do we want to hold off volumes off the market and just find that we hold off 2 million barrels a day and the US expands by 2 million barrels a day and we've just given them all this money.
That's right. Yeah.
Whereas if we actually put the 2 million back on and kept prices a bit lower, we'll actually make more money and that 2 million barrels will never come on in the US.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's all game theory. And
there's other factors, Iran... And the Biden administration are talking reasonable terms. There's very likely going to be a deal there with more Iranian oil.
Well, and the question is, even if there's not a deal because of, Republican optics and Trump in particular, you know, out there, is the question is, even if there's not a deal, will there be a less stringent monitoring of the oil that's coming out of Iran.
Right.
So a lot of oil drips out of Iran in other ways.
Yep.
Yeah.
And if the US sort of just looks the other way because they don't want to come to an explicit deal because you know, that would be seen as a huge negative for a lot of Republicans.
Yep.
But they might just look the other way a while.
Let it go.
Libya's coming back too. I mean, there are a few countries, Venezuela, etc., who are in, you know, structural decline, but it just looks like plenty of oil.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Great answer. Mentioned Biden before, so we might as well wheel out the question from Totti. How far along in the legislative process is the Biden stimulus, and has it been approved in Congress yet?
No, it's still in...
So this is the infrastructure stimulus. We got some stimulus that came out earlier on, which is all done and dusted.
Yeah, I mean, they're going through the politicking now. It's my view on this is that the Democrats are basically pretending to pretending at cooperating with the Republicans, but they've sort of learned now that the Republicans aren't really worth talking to. They're sort of Tony Abbott wreckers, and that's about it. And so they're just going through the motions, so they look like to the public that they're trying.
Right.
But their real plan is to push this through what's called budget reconciliation, which they can do by the end of August. And that's how Trump got his corporate tax cuts through. It's a separate kind of policy track that enables you to vote. So to go through the Senate, you've got to get 60 votes.
Okay.
You need to get more than a majority, but if you go through the budget reconciliation process, you only need your 51, which they've got. And so all they've really got to do is negotiate in-house with the Democrats, who are either busting their balls to get a new military base in their constituency, or someone who's got an ideological bent. And they'll bend all those guys one way or another.
Yep.
You know, we might see the numbers nudged around, but I think it's a near certainty that the package will get through relatively intact by Q3.
Mm-hmm.
But it will take longer. It's infrastructure, so it's...
There's a lead time
on it. So it's really a 2023 rollout.
Okay.
But I think it's very likely to get up.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Very good.
There was a gold question.
Now we're over to the investment outlook and wrap up. Thanks to Greg for this one. What is the outlook for gold? I'm thinking instability is the only predictable tailwind nowadays.
Yeah, I agree.
See the yellow metal.
I pretty much agree with that. I mean, if we're bullish on the US dollar, at least in the short term, bullish on US real rates, then all of that's gold negative.
Yep. Okay.
Yep. So I would agree with that statement.
Nice, easy one. Okay, very good. Last one here I can see, and feel free to drop in any others. From TS, are coal companies going to be the new cigarette companies? Low PEs, unloved, but great returns. Australia with the best quality and low costs into Japan, Southeast Asia. New coal-powered growth. So thoughts on coal, gentlemen, probably in the short term. I know we've got some broader... Got some more broader solar and battery arguments in the long term, but do we see? I was just going to drop in. Bitcoin's seems to be gobbling up a bit of coal in there in China, I'm told. News out today.
Catching a falling knife there.
Yep.
Look, maybe you get it by the handle, maybe you get it by the blade. You know.
Okay.
I guess it's I think there's. I think your characterization is right in terms of saying that it's like the cigarette companies. I think the cigarette companies, their real win when everyone gave up on them in the must have been 2010-ish, and they had a great decade of performance on the back of pumping volumes through
emerging markets.
Yep. And so that's back to coal, is like can they
find the bitter of last resort.
Yeah, but and will they manage to get it through and push through a decade worth of growth in emerging markets,
yeah.
Or will emerging markets actually be pressured back into cutting back on coal and putting more solar and more batteries and things like that?
Yep.
I guess it's an open question. I think if you had a Trump presidency, I think you've got greater scope for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think under a Biden presidency, you're going to see a lot more pressure brought to bear on countries like Australia, who are sort of trying to step outside the whole, not really make commitments to getting to zero emissions.
Yep.
I think you're playing with fire. Look, you might make some great returns, but it's got a significant amount of risk to it. And the big risk is cigarette companies didn't have other countries saying, we don't want any smoking in Indonesia because it's going to stuff things up for us. I was saying, oh well, if you guys want to smoke,
we've told
you what the dangers are. If you decide not to, that's your choice.
Yeah.
Whereas
coal is a global problem.
Coal is a global, exactly, yeah. And that they will be bringing Indonesia's and India's and places like that. And reality is for a lot of the countries that aren't very developed in terms of their grid infrastructures. Take India as an example. Localized, wind, solar, battery actually makes way more sense than actually saying let's build a national grid, and coal fire the whole thing. So
yeah, right.
you know, I think there's enough economic arguments behind those. So, but you know, there'll be 1 or 2 years where you'll make fantastic returns from coal, and then they'll be living down at the end. So,
is there a risk too, where from this sort of the as you said, the global zero emissions sort of targets to say, okay, we're going to just start putting, you know, huge amounts of pressure on the supply side, which would be Australia, who are at some point probably going to get caught up in it, and you know, there'll be some sort of a global import tax or export tax rather than...
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the benefit for Australia is we've got the best quality coal, so...
We're not allowed to use it.
Yeah, what I mean by that is, you know, the coal you have, or sorry, in areas we have, so say the Victorian coal, that's some of the worst quality coal,
yep.
But the coal you get out of Indonesia, for example, is quite poor quality, and so what you pump out a lot more carbon for every kilowatt of energy that you want to produce.
Yep.
So
there's an argument to say use the clean coal.
Exactly. If you're going to do it as a you know, with a purely I guess economic look at the whole thing, you'd say, yeah, okay, let's start phasing out all this Indonesian coal. Let's use heaps of Australian coal and let's make sure that's sort of the last coal we use as we work it all down.
Yeah, sure.
That won't be what happens. Mm. But you know, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, the flip side is it's probably more likely that countries like Australia you'll get enough groundswell of support.
Yep.
And the other issue in Australia is obviously is that we've got much higher electricity prices than most other countries, in particular the US. And what that means is that it means solar and wind and everything are actually more attractive in Australia because we've got such high electricity prices. We've got this cost curve coming down and down and down. It becomes more economically viable for us to switch to renewable technologies earlier than it does, say, in the US.
Absolutely.
And so, yep. And so once you start getting more of that, that'll probably drive more community support for renewables versus coal.
The black stuff. All right, very good.
I should probably add coking coal.
Hmm.
The outlook there is probably okay.
Mm-hmm. Is it metallurgical coal?
That's going into making steel.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
we have a near monopoly on the best quality stuff there, but globally. But I mean, we're seeing the thin end of the wedge on steel greening in China, you know, but I think that'll be a very slow widening wedge. Well, it's not...
Yeah, and economically speaking, you say, okay, well, because I was talking about that solar plus batteries in Australia is pretty close to, well, it is at the level where it's worth putting on solar, and it's almost worth putting solar plus batteries rather than conventional.
Yep.
When you look at steel and producing green steel and using things other than coal in order to get the carbon in there...
Yep.
The economics don't add up yet.
Yeah, sure.
And so that's where... so if it is, it's because governments are actually putting tariffs or things on to actually force that to happen,
right,
rather than the natural
economics. And the R&D sort of things.
Whereas what we're saying for Australian energy is the natural economics are hitting already.
Okay. There's a couple of risks in coking coal at the moment as well with China's bans on Australia. For instance, that's kind of flooding the seaborne market with coal because China's forced to produce more internally, and get it from Mongolia and stuff.
Okay.
Which means that all other markets are a little bit oversupplied in the short term. And then a slowing steel output isn't great for met coal either.
Yep.
For the next few years.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, very good. There was a question there from Greg, which I think we just covered vis-a-vis the coking. Finally, Peter, impact of weaker Australian dollar on stretched Australian consumers. You're going to stop buying televisions because they cost a bit more, do you think? Or
look, most of, you know, we had the huge drop in the dollar from $1.11 to, we went all the way, well, briefly went down to the mid-50s, didn't we? But the big drop post the commodity boom in 2011, we got a sort of down under 70, and we saw almost no tradable inflation come from that. The importers and exporters just absorbed it in their margins. It's competitive business, most of it, and so there was some tradable inflation, but much smaller than most people expected.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not really concerned about that impacting consumers terribly, unless we really get a big dump, you know, below 50 or something that might...
Sustained.
Yeah.
It hasn't been hedged away.
But yeah, I think that's something you worry about once we're getting into the low 60s and heading into the 50s. That's, you know, if it's a matter of going from 77 or whatever down to 70, then that's not as much of an issue.
Mm. Yeah.
Might spark off a car company. Who knows?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the Forex chart versus when the Australian car companies closed, it's pretty depressing stuff.
Yeah.
They pretty much announced all their closures when we were up around $1.10.
Yeah.
They'd all be exporting their asses off now.
Yeah. I mean, that was Ross's comment, you know, as he was saying, you know, when we had Ross Gunnow on a few weeks ago, saying, you know, they were talking at $1.10 or whatever, saying we're shutting down and saying, well, if we could get 80 cents, you know, we'd be fine.
Yep.
And so, and at 77 or 75, whatever, as David said, they're making good money.
They're in clover.
So, but the thing is, they're not going to start up again with that.
No.
So, you know, that's done and dusted for... It was exactly what he was saying. You need much lower currency in order to bring those back because they need to be able to look and go, well, you know, the Aussie dollar's been at 60 cents or below for so long now. Mm. Hey, if I started some sort of manufacturing operation there, that'd be fantastic. And even if the currency went up 10 cents, I'd still be really profitable.
Mm.
Whereas I think at the moment they'll be looking at it going, yeah, it's been a volatile currency. If at 77 might be all right, but if I have to worry about going up to 80s and 90s, then I'm not going to be profitable, so I won't be setting it up.
And I suppose the question that if we could bring down some of the input costs like power, then maybe, you know, an 85 cent dollar is still doable for manufacturing. So
Don't get Dave started on power. There's a whole podcast in that, but yeah,
very good.
Power's not something particularly well done.
No, that's okay. So I'm just wrapping up. So final investment outlook. I feel like we've covered the broad church of the dollar inputs and the drivers. So we're pretty happy there.
So, well, I think the key message from the investment output is that we think there's enough. We've seen enough. We're concerned enough about where the Aussie dollar is that now's the time to be really getting your money offshore.
Okay.
And taking advantage of this, the currency where it is today. Mm-hmm. And if it rises further, then more assets into that offshore. Because basically, what happens is if you own international shares and the Aussie dollar falls from 77 cents down to 70, you've just made a 10% return. And so
with the equity doing nothing.
With the equity doing nothing, exactly. Yeah. And then if the equities go up as well, then you obviously make a lot more on that.
Yep.
So in our view, that's the trend is forget whether it's this week it's going up or next week it's going up, whatever. Mm-hmm. The trend over the next few years is a lower Aussie dollar, and so you want to have more international assets than Australian assets.
Mm.
Whereas the opposite's been true for the last 12 months.
Yep.
And so we've sort of switched our portfolio around to we're sort of on the view that we didn't think it would last, but we certainly had to pay respect to the view that the Aussie dollar was rising, and so mm-hmm. we had more Australian assets than international.
Sure.
And about a month ago, I guess maybe a little bit more, we've sort of started to switch that around, and now we're the opposite in terms of having a lot more international assets. Yeah. And
as Damo says, if it rises again, we'll rotate some more.
Yep. Mm. Yep. Sure.
So
very
it's,
good.
It's buy international on the rallies, basically.
Yep. Okay. Mm. Excellent. Thanks, gents. And just one final question, a bit of a segue into our viewer question as well, is where do you see the AUD USD in 6 months' time? I'll take a higher or lower if you want to have a stab at a range, perhaps. Six months?
Well, shall we say year end?
Okay, let's go year end.
A bit easier.
Yeah, sure.
Lower.
Lower?
Yeah.
How much lower? Handle?
I thought you said I could pass fail.
Can we see a six handle, do you think?
No, I'd be surprised if we got that far down that quickly.
Okay.
But it does move fast.
Mm.
Iron ore is a huge input, and September period Q3 is really weak for iron ore, and China will be slowing. Who knows?
Yep.
So shall we say 72?
All right. Well, I'm not going to hold you to it. Someone might though.
Yeah, I'm sure the internet's a big place. There'll be plenty of people to hold us to.
Well, we're tipping lower, aren't we, anyway, for those factors?
I'm tipping lower. But as Damo says, this is about the trend, and we think we're pretty clearly going through the topping process here for the Aussie, and the prospect of the next few years is the trend lower.
Mm. Okay, very good.
And the big ones, we've spoken about some of the big things to look on, but, I think for me... watching their Chinese building cycle.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably
mm-hmm.
the big one because that'll drive commodity prices. We think you'll get it weakening now as you know, as the rest of the economy starts to fade in. So
yep.
you will see that that's probably a key swing factor. If something happens and China feels the need to, you know, let's say there's a lot more trade tensions and China feels the need, their growth's weakening and they have to go out and build another 100 million apartments, then they will.
Yeah, sure.
And even if they're non-economic and they're all half of them are empty and all that type of stuff.
Yep. Or they're tearing them down and building them.
And that'll get your Aussie dollar, keep it high and get commodity prices going. But you'd have to say the base case is that China's already building, you know, on our numbers, if you look at the amount of floor space under construction,
mm-hmm.
it's about 80 to 90 million homes they're building right now.
Yep.
And there's about 400 and something odd million households in China.
Mm-hmm.
So basically one in six people is having a house built today.
Yeah, that's right.
In China. it's a big spend.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll grow bigger.
Yep.
Maybe it'll be one in two people, you know. But at some stage you have to say at one in six, that's too high for an economy.
Mm.
It will come down over time and building more, you know, knocking down houses in order to build them isn't a productive use of an economy's resources.
Yep.
But if you just want to give people jobs and
growth for growth's
and
sake,
keep your legitimacy as a political party,
yep.
then maybe that's what you'll do just to keep things ticking over.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Yeah, very good. Thanks, gentlemen. Yeah, great show. And I'll hand over to our viewer question of the week for those listening in. If you wouldn't mind dropping in your answers in the comments. So where do you see the Aussie dollar? And we've picked the AUD USD. You can pick another pair if you like in the next 6 months or year end as we've taken. Always interested to see your comments in the chat box and reflecting on those. So with that, thanks very much to all of those who watched in live for another great episode. And to all of those who've asked some questions, we had some terrific and broad ranging questions today. So that was wonderful. I hope you've taken away some great ideas. And if you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video to give us some feedback. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date with news from us, follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who'd get something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. So thanks again for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team. And we look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.